You're listening to the Fat Dude Digs Flicks Movie Podcast Network.
And now, let's talk about with your host, Andy the Fat Dude.
Is up, everybody. This is Andy, the resident fat dude of Fat Dude Digs Flicks, coming to you recorded from Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and it is time for an all-new episode of Let's Talk About. If this is your first time listening to Let's Talk About, hello, welcome, thanks for joining us. Let's Talk About is a chat show where I am joined by a guest to talk about their life, their loves, and a movie that has had an impact on them. How's everybody doing? Y'all doing okay out there? Y'all enjoying the weather? If you're a listener in the South Dakota area, it has been unseasonably warm, which, you know, means it's in the 30s, like pretty consistent. I think we got up to the 42 today. How cool is that? And so all the snow that we had, the one blast of snow that we had, is already starting to melt. But you know, this is South Dakota, so, you know, by in like 3 weeks, shit will probably hit the fan again. Yeah, it's nice for me because I am a wimp, when it comes to driving and bad weather. I've lived here now most of, like, I've probably lived in South Dakota more than anywhere else in my life, and I still am not, you know, not the world's best winter weather driver. I think it also depends on the vehicle that you have. Like, you know, there has to be a smart driver behind the wheel in that vehicle. But I've got an old car. And, you know, again, I hope it holds up, knock on wood, that everything stays together. But, you know, in a perfect world, I'd have a big person's SUV instead of have a big person's hatchback. So that's cool. This is not what you came to the show to listen to, me talking about the weather and vehicles. You came to the show because you want to listen to a conversation about movies. And you'll get that. I'm just trying to think if there's any other bases I need to cover. This year I've been participating in some letterboxed challenges, and that has really given me a cool opportunity to get to watch movies that I haven't seen before, and I am going to try very hard to stick with those challenges over the course of the year. I am now a little behind on my Criterion challenge. The movie that is holding me up is the movie that I have watched the first half of, like, I think 7 times now. That number is probably not correct, but I've watched the first half of The Seven Samurai multiple times and have not gotten around to the second half of it. Well, it is the next movie on my list, and I want to watch this entire movie. So I am going to finish The Seven Samurai here sometime this week. That's the real goal. The real goal is getting through The Seven Samurai. And that, you know, it's not that I haven't enjoyed it. I've really enjoyed it. I understand why its reputation is the way that it is. It's just something would come up after the first half of the movie and I wouldn't be able to watch the second half. And I feel intimidated by that. I feel like I'm going to start the movie and it's going to happen again. So, I don't know. I'm gonna get it watched. I'm gonna get it watched. That might actually be my biggest goal of 2024, is to finish that movie. What else? I did a whole podcast on the Oscar nominations, so I don't need to talk any more about that here. Yeah. I mean, I could talk about wrestling and how, any thoughts or presumptions that Vince McMahon is a monster seem like they've been confirmed. So that's something. Hopefully, I just I hope that anyone who knew about it and covered for Vince over his years of bad behavior gets held accountable for what happened. That could potentially mean some of the people who have helped orchestrate this turnaround. And that's sad, but there's no excuse for being a, like, security blanket for a abuser, sex trafficker. No. So, if you were on Team Vince and wanted to maintain, you know, stay on Team Vince and keep his business secret, you gotta go. It's a new era, and they gotta do better. And hopefully, that's what happens. Again, all of these topics so far are not why you've chosen to listen to a movie podcast. An interview movie podcast at that. So, let's turn things around. It's time to get down to business. I'm joined this week by a theatrical educator for Minot State University, Sarah Honorman, and you'll hear right away that I messed up her name right out the gates. She corrected me, and if I recall correctly, I don't think I said her last name for the rest of the interview, just because I was afraid to screw it up. But I'm going to say it again, Honorman, just to show that I listened and am not going to screw it up again. But yeah, Sarah joins us for this awesome interview where we talk about her life, her theatrical career, and we talk a little bit about her dad, because that's kind of an interesting, you know, an interesting thing that I know and adore her dad, and she thinks he's okay too. So go ahead and pop your popcorn, grab your soft drink, kick back, relax, and let's talk about Birdman or the unexpected virtue of ignorance. All right, everyone. I am, you know, again, I first off, I say every week that I'm super excited. And then I say every week that I say every week that I'm excited. So it's just kind of this like revolving circle of things that I constantly say. But the truth of the matter is that I'm always excited when I get to have a guest on that I'm not familiar with. Like, I feel like this is the first genuine conversation that I've had with a person. That always makes me really excited. It's like, oh, cool. It feels like the first day of kindergarten and I'm making a new friend. So I am always for that. So my new friend today, my guest on the show today is Sarah Honorman. Sarah, did I mess up the last name? And second off, how are you?
close. It's Honorman. Honorman. My husband always tells people it's like Han Solo.
Oh, that's easy to remember.
And I'm I'm doing great, Andy. It's awesome. Fun to be here.
Yeah, I'm really excited to get to chat with you. You are an educator in the theatrical realm, which as a former theater student and, you know, actor on hiatus, I just you're like my favorite kind of person in the world. Like trying to get more people into the world of acting. It's so wonderful. So I'm really excited to kind of chat with you about your theatrical background. But first, we'll kind of start with the same question I ask everybody. And that is, Sarah, who are you? Where did you come from? What is your origin story?
Awesome. I love it. Every time I listen to your show, I'm always excited. The origin story.
Yeah.
I grew up in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and actually, this is just a funny coincidence. I'm always talking to, especially theater people, about how mm-hmm. small the world really is. But my dad is Greg Belfridge, who's on the radio in Sioux Falls. And when I reached out to you, you were like, hey, I see your name's Belfridge. Is there any relation? So that was kind of a cool, you know, experience to know that we didn't know each other, but we had a connection through that.
Yeah.
And I went to Washington High School, so I pretty big school. I mean, I think I had a class of 500 plus students or whatever. And I really enjoyed it there. And that's where I got to start with, that's where my theatricality really began. So anyone who knows my dad knows that he is a huge theater guy. He used to do all sorts of plays. My favorite story to tell people is when Sioux Empire Community Theater did Annie back in the early 90s. And my dad really wanted me to go to auditions with him. And I was very shy, not at all ready to commit to auditioning for a play. So instead, I went to a sleepover. And then I got to watch my dad play Franklin Delano Roosevelt in Annie the Musical. And I kind of fell in love with being an audience member from that moment on. And so my grandparents were a really big supporter of the arts. My grandma still is. My grandpa sadly passed away, but they would take us to the Prairie Rep shows. They would take us to all sorts of things to just kind of get us acquainted with the arts. And those were always my favorite, where when they said, "We get to go see a play today." And so I loved being in the audience, but it was not until I was a sophomore in high school that one of my best friends finally was like, "You really need to do oral interpretation." And I was like, "Oh, I don't know." And she twisted my arm. I gave in to some positive peer pressure. And it was at that point that we were moving on to state. And our coach at the time would have other teachers watch us before we'd go. So I had to go perform my dramatic piece for actually one of the theater directors at Washington, who told me, I will never forget it. She told me, "If you don't show up for one act auditions, I will hunt you down." And I was like, oh gosh, I was actually really nervous about the consequences if I didn't show up. And that's when I finally got into theater, was I showed up for those auditions, I was cast, and then I was immediately hooked. So from there, I kind of knew that I always wanted to be an educator. I met my husband Seth through theater people. So I ended up going up to Northern State University in Aberdeen, South Dakota, and that's where I got my bachelor's degree in English education with a minor in theater. It's kind of one of those things where I was our major at the time at Northern was a musical theater degree, and I never viewed myself as a singer. I love performing, but I never viewed myself as a singer. So I was like, well, I don't know if I could handle that as a major, but I'll keep the minor. And I learned under Larry Wilde and Daniel Yergitis, and they were some of the like best professors I ever had while I was there. They really cultivated my love for being on stage. And that's when I was actually first introduced to this concept of directing, which I never would have thought I would enjoy otherwise. I think I thought forever, oh, I'll just be an actor. I love being on the stage, which I still do. But directing took me into a whole new world. So after I graduated, we stayed in the Aberdeen area for about 4 years. I spent 4 years teaching English and theater in Groton, South Dakota. So it's like I know in Midwest we talk more taught how much time it takes versus mileage, but it's about a half hour drive from Aberdeen.
It's a good solid 45 minutes from.
Yeah, exactly. Every time someone talks to me in miles, I'm like, can you just tell me like the length of time
How long will that take me?
it will take? Exactly. So I did that, and the whole time I was like, oh, I don't know. I like directing, but is this what I want to do? And then my husband, who also is, like I mentioned, we met through theater people. He's a huge theater person as well. And he and I both wanted to pursue our MFAs in theater. And we were going to go at the same time. And then the universe said, hey, would you like a kid? And we said, okay.
All right.
So that sort of, changed the direction we were going in. For many, positive reasons though too. Of
Yeah.
course, we wanted kids. That was always part of our plan.
Right.
So we had a healthy, beautiful daughter who's now 8 years old. Time goes so fast. It's
Yeah.
crazy. And so Seth, I said, Seth, you go to school first. And he
Sure.
did. So we ended up moving to Mankato, Minnesota. And we both eventually ended up going through the program there at Minnesota State University, Mankato. We had just heard really good things about the program. We had several friends who had been involved in the program, asked directors specifically. And so we knew that was kind of where we wanted to go because the program was more geared towards, in many ways, at least for direction, it's really good if you want to go on to be an academic,
Yeah.
which both of us did.
Right.
And so Seth took his 3 years, and then I took my 3 years. And in the interim, we ended up adopting our son, Roderick. So now we have an 8-year-old and a 1-year-old, and life is
Wow.
crazy and beautiful and wonderful and
Yeah.
busy and very,
Yeah.
very busy. On top of being theater people,
Right.
if you're a theater
Where
person listening, you understand the how
Which is
crazy that can
like
be.
already absurdly busy all
All
the time.
the time. I think
Oh
my
boy.
favorite shirts I've ever seen are those I can't, I have
Yeah.
rehearsal, because
Yeah.
they're so accurate.
That's it. That's life. That's what
Yeah,
it
that's what you
you
do.
you've kind of like it's funny because it's like you haven't really given up on a social life because you are like when you're amongst theater people, it is probably the most social element of all. But it's like, you're not going out. You're not like, from evenings from like 7 to 9 when a lot of people are at restaurants or going out to the movies or fun stuff like that. You're probably at rehearsal. There's that's
Yes.
where you're gonna be.
Yep.
So
Yep,
yeah.
exactly. And it's a beautiful blend, like you said, of being able to socialize, just not in, the quote standard way
Yeah,
of
yeah,
socializing
yeah.
necessarily.
Well, oh, go ahead.
I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I want to make sure that we get through your story before I start
For
like saying,
sure.
I got a question, I got a
No, that's totally fair. I think I'm
question.
almost done.
Sure.
So I graduated this May, this past May, of 23, and we have found ourselves now in Minot, North Dakota. So I took a position at Minot State University. It is very far north in North Dakota.
Yeah.
It is like 2 hours away from the Canadian border. So when we had that week of like really cold temps, it was gnarly up here. I
Brutal,
know,
brutal cold.
yeah.
Oh,
I was not
gosh.
ready for it, I'll be
Yeah.
honest. But I'm, living the dream, as they say. I was able to take an assistant professor of theater position up here. So I'm a one person department currently. I've
Yeah.
got several incredibly dedicated students who I love dearly. We actually just got back from the Kennedy Center American College Theater Festival for
Yeah.
Region 5, which is just this, if you don't know, it's this beautiful culmination of, and I'm gonna misstep because I don't remember every single state that is in our region. I'm a little embarrassed, but you've got like Minnesota, South Dakota, North Dakota, Iowa, they're like Nebraska, all of these states that come together with university theater practitioners, students. They're competing for fellowships and scholarships, and they get to bring productions with them, and they get to attend workshops. And I have fond memories of attending it when I was a student, and just to watch this year, watch my students' faces light up as this was the very first time they got to go, was just so wonderful to
Yeah.
see that love that I remember feeling the first time I got to go. So.
Yeah. What's that kind of like for you? To be, once the, I guess you're on the flip side of it, because it's like I remember going too, and it was just so much fun. Like, you get to be there with your friends, you get to be around all of these other theater people, like doing this thing that you love. Sometimes, you compete, and the competition is, it's tough, because it's like, sometimes it's better if you don't think of it as a competition. It's just another opportunity to, like, oh, cool, I get to act in front of these people. So what's it kind of like to be on that flip side, to watch as the students? You said that it was just a joy for you to kind of watch how they lit up. But what were some differences in the experience kind of this time around for you?
Oh, for sure. Well, I still, went and enjoyed some of the shows and the finals and all of that kind of stuff. But it's kind of cool now to watch. I like this summer, I've got a couple of contracts to go direct at varying summer theaters. So it's now I'm watching it through the eyes of like, ooh, I really want to work with that person. I'd love to direct them. And it's a lot of really cool collaborations. So one of the fun things that I got to do that I just really enjoyed was there's a faculty acting showcase. And so my good friend Trevor Belt and I got to perform a piece together, and it was really cool to watch the students because they were like, "Oh my gosh, now our directors have to do the acting, like we get to watch them on stage instead of them watching us." So it was really kind of fun to see how they responded to that stuff. And it's just an awesome time. It's still a great way to connect for us educators too, because there was one show I saw that was an original piece that was written by another professor, and I've already been emailing and I'm like, "Hey, I really love this piece. Is there any, like what would it look like to put this on at our university and that kind of stuff?" So it's just awesome to be able to collaborate in that way too, and pick each other's brains about how we deal with moving forward with theater. And AI has been a big topic, even in the realm of theater. That's become a big conversation piece. So it's just really, it was a great way for me to, it was weird, because last year I was there as a grad student and this year I was there as a faculty member. So it was very strange, but it was also just kind of this beautiful, I got to catch up with all my Mankato professors and seeing them in a new real colleague light as opposed to a student light was really fun.
I can imagine that flip from like student to educator mode in such a like quick, concurrence of time is maybe jarring, but also really exciting, because it's like these people that you just work with or worked with on one level is now, now you're kind of on a very level playing field of trying to accomplish the same thing. And I think it's got to be a really interesting and amazing feeling to kind of get to reconnect with those people once you go back to this pretty big deal of a festival in the collegiate theater world.
Yes, yeah, it really is.
So from a directorial standpoint, and you had said something, you saw the play that was written by another professor, and that really caught your interest. So then from a directorial standpoint, what kind of stories excite you? Like, what do you like to I guess focus on when you're directing? I imagine, like, in the world of being an educator, there are a lot of kind of a lot of hoops that you might have to jump through, and kind of you have to pick a show that pertains to a certain rule set. But I'm always just curious, like, what kind of stories do you enjoy getting the opportunity to present for the students and the audiences that frequent the theaters in that area, or the areas where you're getting the chance to direct, with the gigs over the next year, the paid directorial gigs?
Absolutely. So I'm a really strong advocate for, as a female identifying individual, I really tend to gravitate, I guess is the word that I'm looking for, towards those stories. So like Sarah Ruhl is probably one of my absolute favorite playwrights. My thesis production was her show In the Next Room, which is, this beautiful tale of, a woman trying to find empowerment in her own marriage and relationship as she's seeing her husband help other women, but not her. And so that's what I'm primarily drawn to is stories typically about femme characters written by female playwrights. Paula Vogel is another one I absolutely adore. But I also just really like stories that really relay the human experience, which is part of, truthfully, what I think I love most about the theatrical art, is finding yourselves in these stories that don't necessarily tell your story, but certainly have elements of what it means to be just a human, and how we all make mistakes, how we all suffer, how we all strive for perfection, but of course never actually achieve it.
I think one of the things that for me, like, this is a movie podcast, so clearly I love movies, can talk about movies all day. But I think for me, one of the things that makes the world of theater so great for telling these stories that deal with, like, social consciousness, or deal with, things that might even be politically relevant, is that there is no, like, there's no screen. It is the actors are telling the story on stage. The audience is right there, right, physically present, able to watch this whole thing kind of unfold over the course of 2, 3 hours. And it's like, it feels tangible. It feels very real, and it gives you that opportunity to kind of connect with people in a different way. Not saying that you can't connect with movies. God knows, I've
Oh,
watched
absolutely.
so many movies, but there's something about that that experience of, like, even from an actor's standpoint, being able to be out on stage, and when you can actually see, like, an audience member viscerally react to
Hear
something.
them laugh. Yeah. It's different.
Does that, I hate to ask, like, does that play any impact in the things that you choose? But not even so much that. Is it, like, is it just kind of, I can't think of a way to ask this question that I want to ask, but it's like, does that motivate your selection, trying to think of things that you think an audience will react to in a certain way? You can never predict what an audience is going to do,
Oh,
but I
absolutely.
always wonder if it's like, oh, this would be something that I feel is important because I feel like an audience is going to take it a certain way. Does that play any impact in your, I guess, creative process?
Absolutely, it does. And I think, as especially for me, I'm a one person department now. So as I'm picking those shows, I have to connect with what is the audience here going to care about, because as you mentioned, you can't necessarily predict how an audience will react. Sometimes you think something is hilarious and your audience, it just falls flat for whatever reason. But I do think that consciousness is so important. So what are the values that are held in any given area, and how can we address those while still, advocating for change and things like that? But yes, I do tend to keep that in mind as I'm doing season selection.
And how much of it then is, I feel like, as a theater person, we all have our dream shows, like the shows that we either want to direct or that we want to act in. Like, how much of that is, I'm gonna do 75% for them and 25% for me. How does that kind of factor in? Is there ever that moment where you're just like, oh, I'm gonna be selfish?
That's a great question, and that's like the game. You know what I mean? It's knowing that at the end of the day, on whether you like it or not, especially at a at an institution, you have to make money, right? Your program has to be viable, so you have to pick stuff that people are going to come see. But you also have to find ways to motivate your love of the theater. I think what happens sometimes is that people just see well, I have to make money, I have to do this, I have to do this, and then they start to lose their love for it. So I think if you stick strictly to the just audience, then it ends up hurting your creative process. So for me, I would say, yeah, it's probably an 80-20 split. Even in the season I'm looking at right now, many of them are shows that I want to do, but I'm also trying to look at, well, this is a show that I could bring in, elementary students or families or whatever it happens to be. Oh, and it just happens to be a show I really like. No, I can justify it at least. But yeah, I think probably an 80-20 split with 20% being selfishness.
And I think that's fair. I feel like you have to be able to have that little bit for you that might just be for you, because I think that's kind of it's not taking advantage of the situation, but it's that thing that really like calls to you as an artist, and you have the opportunity to do something like that. Like I really feel like having that small percentage where you still get this chance to be like, listen, I want to do this. I feel like I can justify why we do this. Let's put this on. And even if right now, if you say, I'm going to do this show, and five people across campus know what it is, and several thousand people have no idea what it is and have never heard of it, you kind of set yourself up with the reputation that, like, oh, well, listen, I saw this play because it was, God, I hate to use this as an example, but it was Romeo and Juliet, and I loved it, and it was great. So, I know they did a good job there. Those same people are in the department, so let's go see this show that I've never heard of before. So I think it's a good way to kind of like challenge audiences to come back and experience something that they haven't before by doing something that is, may start off as this idea of this is a show that I want to do, so I'm gonna do it.
Agreed. And I think that that's, again, one of the beautiful things about theater is challenging ourselves, whether that's as the people who are up on stage or the production team or the audience, even, challenging your own perceptions of what the world is and what the world could be.
Let's go backwards a little bit here. So,
For sure.
when you were and you still do act, like you still get the opportunity to perform on stage, you still enjoy that. But when you were in high school and when you were in college, the first go round, what was it for you as an actor that really either got you excited to be up on stage, or maybe even roles that you had that you were just like, thank God, I had the chance to do this. What was it that kind of made you thrive as a performer?
I think it was just the ability to be people that I never would be. I found myself at many shows being the bad guy, and people who know me are like, "Yeah, that's not Sarah." At least I like to think they don't think of me as a bad guy anyway. My students might think differently, who knows? But like I got my one of my first full productions at Northern State was in The Three Musketeers as Milady. And it was I think for me it's just like all the things you get to learn that you wouldn't probably otherwise have gotten to learn. I can't remember. I totally can't be honest with you. I don't remember how long it was. I want to say it was like 2 weeks that we spent like solid work learning how to use daggers and rapiers, and it was like the coolest thing ever. I just we had this. They brought in a fight choreographer and we just had boot camp like over parts of winter break. And it was the coolest experience. Had I not been in that show, I don't think I ever would have done that, how many people are just like, yeah, I know how to casually use a rapier. Like maybe there's more than I expect, but still, So it was it's a big piece of like just getting to do things you wouldn't otherwise do. Like I don't think I would ever hit a friend with a book, but that happened to me in a show. My friend had to smack me with this book of stamps, and so all the cool, crazy things you get to learn about, and experience, and then just the connections. I think the people that have stayed with me the longest in my life are the people that I've met through theater. Even if we don't talk on a daily basis, it's a casual check-in every once in a while. But my best friends have absolutely come from theater, and it's just this wonderful way to connect with humans on a very different level and experiencing things that you might, like I said, I'm being a little repetitive, so I apologize, but
No.
experience things that you might not get to otherwise.
Yeah. It feels like those are the friends that I like to call the pick up right where you left off kind of friends. Because it's like you could go months, in some instances go years without having like a full-fledged conversation with these people. But the moment that you like strike up another chat, it's as if, no time has passed. It's you pick up right where you left off. I feel like that's most of my long-term friendships. I may not talk to them every day, may not talk to them monthly. But when I do reconnect with them, it's like,
We never
we
stopped.
know, we're still best friends. It was funny that you were talking about the Three Musketeers. I had a conversation this weekend for myself that somebody had asked, what were your favorite roles that you had ever done? And one of the plays that I did was the Scottish play. I was Macduff, and we
Oh,
went on
awesome.
this. Yeah, we went on this. The final sword fight was this highly choreographed, brutal fight, and so we went through, weeks of training, like to get in shape and get into like, how to strike and how to wield these broadswords. And I told him, I was like, that was the best shape I have ever been in my life, was during that show. And then I just let it all
Those things are
go.
heavy. You have to
Oh,
be in good shape
wow.
to wield those.
Like, because they expect you to wield them, but then they expect you to move around a lot too. Well, I'm a round dude, so that makes it very challenging. But yeah, I think I was so excited to get to use a sword on stage that I was like, yeah, whatever you want me to do. Like, I'll do sit-ups if you need me to. Let's let's get this taken care
I
of.
just want to use the sword, please.
That's right. What was it for you that kind of made you want to make that switch over from acting to like acting as your main focus to directing as your main focus? Was there something that like kind of stood out to you, or was it just that the opportunity was there and you were like, oh, this is fun, I like this? Like, was there something that really like pushed you from one cat like what I guess one primary area of focus to another?
Initially, it was just out of necessity. My job said, "You're directing these high school students." And I said, "Okay, because I get to do theater." And I had a friend who always said, "Today's a good day because we get to do theater. So any day we can do theater is a good day." And I've kind of just I stole that from her. But so I said, yeah, of course, I'd love to do that. And so for a long time, it was just like I didn't feel like I was very good at it. I thought I was a, I had major imposter syndrome, I think, for a long time about my direction. And then it was when we moved to Mankato and my job at the high school there, I had a show and I just had this insanely talented group of students, and we were going through the one act, and I was just so insanely proud of what they'd done. And I looked at my husband and I said, "Oh my gosh, I think I'm really a director." Like I helped them discover those things, and it was really cool because they'd ask me questions and we would discuss, and they really cared about like the nitty-gritty details of things. And it was at that moment, and he looked at me and he was like, duh, I've been telling you that for, the past 4 years or whatever. So I think it was just being the guiding light and helping others make those discoveries that really made me lean into that direction even more and go to school then instead for directing instead of acting, because I think it's awesome to find those discoveries yourself, but to be a part of watching all of those people find those discoveries as the director, it's just this whole other thing. And I can't really explain it, but it just brings me so much joy to watch them. Like I just directed my first show here in Minot back in October. We did The Shape of Things, and I had my student who played Adam. He would like ask me these really insightful questions, and then he would have what I call light bulb moments. And he'd go, "Oh my gosh, you're in the text." And I'd go, "Yes." So I think it's those moments that for me were really like, okay, yeah, direction. Direction is really where I see myself moving forward.
It is, just as you said, it is this rewarding moment when you're directing a show and you get and the actor, like you're looking for one thing and you can't quite say what it is that you want. You don't want to give the actor a line read, but you want to try and like help them find like this way of delivery, this way of connecting with the character at that point. And when they find it on their own and all of the pieces fall together, it is like, you want to do a victory dance. You just feel so like excited and elated to have watched this whole thing unfold. You talked about the imposter syndrome too, and oh, I have felt that many times because I kind of stumbled into directing. It was something where it was like I went to school for acting. When we did the directing classes, I felt like I was terrible. Like I felt like I just didn't quite grasp the concept of directing. So it was not something that I wanted to dive into. But then I had the opportunity to direct my first show at Old Town. And it was, really small show, just two actors. And yeah, I was just like, oh, I kind of love this. And just from there, like you learn the skill set from like just kind of by doing it. And the last show I directed was a musical, and that made me want to vomit. Because
They're a
good
whole other
Lord,
beast.
oh man! But it turned out so well, and like the cast was just incredible, and they bonded, and you could see that bond on stage, and it was like it just made this incredible experience, I think, for all of us. And that was where I was kind of like, yeah. If I can get back into the realm of theater like on a regular basis, I think this is what I want to do from now on. Because it's just there's something about really being able to help direct people to tell the story. Like how do they convey the emotional connection that needs to be told with the story. So yeah, just so great, so great. I'm going to talk for a second because this is going to tie into your love of movies as well. For people who don't know your father, Mr. Greg Belfridge, that man is a huge fan of Star Trek and Batman. He is a kind of like geek culture connoisseur, I would say. How much of that kind of bled into your like appreciation of entertainment, movies, television, or was it the complete opposite where you were like, my dad annoys me. I don't want to have anything to do with this stuff.
I think of the three of the Belfridge children, I probably was the most influenced in many ways by my dad and my likes for those things. So, but for those of you who don't know, my dad has what he refers to as the Bat Cave. And I, no joke, it's like full, it is full of Batman memorabilia. And that's how I grew up, was in a room full of Batman memorabilia. And so I immediately found myself falling in love. And this will come back into play once we talked about the movie, but I immediately fell in love with Michael Keaton. I immediately fell in love with Batman. I have insanely fond memories of watching Batman, the animated series, when I was growing up. And so I never lost that love. When we were in Mankato, I spent like 2.5 years working at Pulp Comics and Games in Mankato. If you are listening in Mankato, go visit them because they're awesome. But I loved it there. So, and then I married a guy who also loves comics and Batman. So just sort of destined to be a part of my life forever, I think. But yeah, my dad very much influenced what I liked. I again, I have fond memories of watching, we would watch the original series of Star Trek. Captain Kirk was always his favorite. He likes Picard, but Captain Kirk's is his favorite
Oh,
because
yeah.
that's what he grew up with. And we would watch the movies. We would run around the house listening to the music from the movies, the Star Trek movies, just silly stuff. But I very much have retained that love of all things superhero and geek culture and whatnot in my taste of movies.
I just kind of imagine, and I'm not gonna turn this episode into the let me tell you how much I love your dad show. I just kind of imagine that it's like, I feel like it could either go the way of like, oh my gosh, Dad, please stop talking about Star Trek. Please stop talking about Batman. Or you just get so caught up in it. Like his passion for things is
Yeah,
so like,
contagious.
yeah. And so
Yeah.
you kind of want to be like, I want to feel that excited about these things too. And
Yes.
so kind of getting to be able to share that thing with him, I think is just really cool.
I
Yeah.
agree. And my sister and I too, I don't want to speak for my brother, but I know my sister also loves my dad. She would show us the Godzilla movies and monster
Oh
movies. So
yeah.
like we loved that kind of stuff when we were growing up. I think I liken him to a big kid in many ways just because of that passion you're talking about, right? Like
Yeah.
he has never lost that kid-like quality of passion for the things that he really enjoys. And I think that that's such a cool and unique characteristic that he has.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's absolutely contagious.
Yeah. He's got that twinkle, like that twinkle in
Yeah,
his eyes
yep.
when he gets to talk about those things. Yeah,
Yes.
I'll just say one more time, and then we'll move on to the next thing. I love your dad. I just think he's great. And yeah, anytime I get to talk with your dad, I just, he makes my day. So,
Oh, he'll love to hear
yeah,
that.
good, 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 Greg. We should talk again soon. I'm a big softie when it comes to romance and love stories. So I will ask, you're married. I want to know the meeting story. I want to know how things came together for you two. I don't know. I get really soft when like I'm either speaking with like my best friends to hear about their love story, or even people who just like, you brought Seth up a couple of times. So you still like him,
I
so I'm curious to hear a little bit of your story.
Yeah, for sure. So, I think it's a funny story. People look at me funny every time I tell it, but so I should preface with Seth and I actually went to the same high school. So Seth grew up in Sioux Falls as well. He was a senior at Washington when I was a freshman, and as I said, my class was 500 plus people, so you can imagine I didn't know who any of the seniors were at that time. We found out much later that we actually played in the symphony together. I played cello and he played tuba, so we actually would have been like right near each other but didn't know each other. So that's kind of funny. But we did not meet until I was a sophomore in high school and he was a freshman in college. And our like school age is actually bigger than our age gap in years, because I'm a September baby and he's a May baby, so he is at the end of his class and I was at the beginning of mine. But we met at a Guitar Hero party. My friends and I were having a cast party for our one act that I was talking about earlier that I had to audition for, or the director was going to hunt me down. And we had a mutual friend who was actually seeing a show at Augustana College because one of their a senior who had graduated from Washington was in a play there. And so Grant was there and Seth was there. And I guess Grant saw Seth in the audience and was like, "Hey, I'm going to this party. Do you want to come with? You know everybody there." And Seth was like, "Sure, why not?" Because he was home on spring break. And so everyone was freaking out meanwhile as I'm at the party because they're like, "Oh my gosh, Seth's coming. Oh my gosh, Seth's coming." And I was just sitting in the corner going, "Who in the world is that?" Because I had no idea who he was. And my friend Kenny was like, "Oh, don't worry about it. He's a cool guy. He used to be in the theater stuff." And I said, "Okay, sounds good." And at the time, I've found that theater people, you're either actually really introverted in real life or you're really extroverted in real life. And I am the former. I've broadened my horizons as I've gotten older, but when I was in high school, I was still very much like a live in a shell kind of Sarah. And so Seth and Grant came down the stairs, and I immediately thought he was super cute. I tell that just because I feel like it's important to the story. But I sat on the couch and didn't really say anything. And anyone who knows Seth knows that he was the complete opposite of that. So he, of course, looked around the room, knew everybody except for me. And so he sat down right next to me and we started chatting. And he kicked my butt several times at Guitar Hero. And then I had to leave for the night because it was curfew. And at the time, I thought my parents were so uncool because they told me I had to come home. And then all my friends were mad at me because I was the one who owned a Guitar Hero and I had to take it with me.
You ruined the whole party.
Yeah, that's why I was like, "Mom, Dad, please let me stay. Everybody's so mad." They're like, "No, we don't care. Get home." Oh, okay, fine.
Terrible. Damn it, Greg Belfrich.
So I said goodbye to everybody, and at the time, that's when Facebook had started to be like anyone could get a profile or whatever. You didn't have to just be associated with a college at that point anymore. And so Facebook stalked him like any good high schooler would do at that time period. And I learned that he had a girlfriend, and I was kind of disappointed, but I was like, "Well, what are the chances that anything was going to happen anyway?" So it's not a big deal. He was still really cool, so I hit the add friend button, and he added me back. And then we just chatted over Facebook for quite a while. And we would commiserate with each other when we liked people who didn't like us back. And, like we slowly but surely became really good friends. In the meantime, he and his girlfriend, ended up breaking up for whatever reason. But we were just Facebook friends because he was in Aberdeen and I was in Sioux Falls. It's a 3-hour drive. So he'd come home every so often, and he'd ask if I wanted to go for a walk or whatever, and we would hang out here and there. He had a get together at his house once and invited me over. I talked him through getting him prepared for having his wisdom teeth removed because I had already done that. So like we had this really kind of cool blossoming friendship. And then it was clear that it sort of was starting to morph into more than just friendship. So the summer before my junior year of high school, he asked me out, and we've been together ever since.
Oh, that's awesome. That is so awesome. I always like the stories where it's like, well, first we were friends. Yeah, I thought he or she was kind of cute, but we were just friends. That's all it was. And then all of a sudden it's like, as life is happening, it feels like you just got hit by the feelings truck. But looking back at it, you're like, well, duh. Like I just saw, like I knew that was gonna happen. I knew this is how it was gonna come together. So yeah, I just think that's great. I love hearing those stories. I don't know, there's something really
They're
sweet
fun.
about
No,
them.
I agree with you.
Well, we're gonna completely shift gears here now. We're gonna dive into our featured movie of the week. And this week's movie is Birdman or The Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance. Is that right?
Yes.
How did we end up here? This place is horrible. Smells like balls. We had it all. You were a movie star, remember?
Who was this guy?
He used to be Birdman.
I like that poster.
You wrote this adaptation?
I did, yeah.
And you're directing and starring in your adaptation. That's ambitious.
Are you afraid people will say you're doing this play to battle the impression that you're a washed-up comic strip character?
Absolutely not. That's why 20 years ago I said no to Birdman 4.
Birdman 4! You do Birdman 4?
Now you're about to destroy what's left of your career. We should have done that reality show they offered us.
Shut up.
Crab
up
on your ass,
fucking
choke you out.
You know I'm right.
You're so nice.
Hey, what's up? Why don't you try to rest a little bit?
Let's talk about this movie. So before we kind of get started on like thoughts towards the movie, Sarah, in your own words, what is Birdman all about?
Oh, so many things. I think at its heart, Birdman is really about like finding respect and validation in the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I think that at its heart, that's what Regan really wants out of life, is to find respect and validation that as an artist, he's made it, which is paralleled through many of the characters.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you remember the first time that you saw this movie, or the time where it really, I guess, made a huge impact for you?
Absolutely. It was the first time I watched it, and it was so insanely wonderful. And I was immediately drawn to it because as I alluded to earlier, Michael Keaton has been a part of my life since I was a kid. And so I had heard about the concept of it, you know, this quote unquote washed up, you know, movie, you know, superhero movie star trying to make it on Broadway or whatever. And I was like, ooh, I bet that'll be interesting. Ooh, Michael Keaton's in it. All right.
Yeah.
And just, it's so stunning, like the amount of continuous shots that are done in that movie is just I don't have enough good things to say about it.
Yeah. What is it about this movie to you? Why choose Birdman? Why does Birdman stand out to you as something really special?
As a theater artist, I think in particular, that idea of what is real and how do we capture that realness is such an important part of our jobs, that that's one of the things that really stood out to me was wanting love, wanting admiration, wanting all of these things and not feeling like what you've done is ever good enough. I think any artist of any capacity has probably felt that at some point in their lives. And so for me, really that idea of how do we remain relevant, really struck a chord.
I think this movie is incredible. Like I can't remember. I was trying to think if I'd seen this in theaters or not, and I probably did. I just can't remember seeing it in the theater. But I've had the Blu-ray pretty much since the Blu-ray was released. Yep. And I love this movie. I think it is just from a technical standpoint, it is fascinating to watch how it's like, it really feels like the movie is all one shot, but you know that there are seams, you know that there are moments where things had to end. They do really great like transitions from like day to night, where it's just, you know, the camera doesn't break, but it fades in and out in frame, and it just is incredible. But then on top of that, like, you have Michael Keaton, who I think really is just this incredibly underrated actor.
Yes.
Across the board. Like, of course, he's Batman. Of course, he's Beetlejuice. But, like, you know, he was the movie My Life from, like, the 80s and 90s is very, very yep. good. The Paper is really good. I believe later on he would go on to do, like, Spotlight and Jackie yes. Brown. Yep. And just has these, like, fantastic performances where he gets to be very subtle, but all of his characters feel so lived in. Like,
yes.
I completely believe that whatever character he plays exists beyond the movie.
Yep.
And I think that's such a gift for an actor to make me believe that. I think that, you know, every character exists during the runtime of the movie. But if there's a character that, like, I'm left wondering, I'm like, okay, well, what is this guy doing right now? Like, I find that so interesting to watch. And I think, you know, clearly he's the centerpiece. And I wonder how much kind of, like, personal vendetta or grievances he was airing out here in this movie, because I never feel like his performance is bitter, even if the character is. I feel like he's really honest and genuine in his presentation of this character. But then you've got, you know, all of the supporting cast too. And, like, looking back at this cast, like, this is a murderer's row of talent. Edward Norton, Emma Stone, Andrea Riseborough, Amy Ryan, Zach Galifianakis, Naomi Watts. Like, it is just incredible. And, like, there's an actress who plays the stage manager. Her name is Merritt Weaver. She is, like,
I love her.
Oh, she is awesome in everything. And, like,
everything, you know, yeah, yeah.
Such a small part, and, like, probably one of her first, you know, big movies. And I'm just like, oh my god, I love her. It's so cool to see her in this movie.
I love the moment when Michael Keaton's character Regan is like, get him off the stage, and she looks at him and goes, how do you want me to do that? she's so funny.
So good. I guess, kind of, like, maybe starting with performances that's a good place to begin here. What kind of stands out to you from, you know, from all of them, or, like, you know, the performances that are the I guess most notable here? How did you connect with them? How did those characters kind of make this movie something that really resonates with you?
Sure. I feel like I could talk forever about all of them, to be honest with you. But I really love watching Emma Stone. I just think her character has such an interesting character arc throughout the movie. And I don't know that everyone would have been able to tackle that. So it's really cool to watch her, you know, personify this individual who's going through, you know, she's been through rehab and now she's trying to put her life together and, you know, trying to struggle through working for her dad, which doesn't sound all that glamorous. And watch him kind of go through this downward spiral as he's trying to do this show. So I find myself always fascinated by her and just how she handles those changes, because you can obviously see there's this clear connection she has with her dad. She cares about him, but she's also going through her own stuff, as it were, that she's not really sure how to address all of these things that are coming up. And I just think she handles that gracefully and, like, believably, which is always, you know, what I think we want to look for in, you know, an actor's approach to a specific character. I love Edward Norton's character, whose name is currently escaping me. I apologize, but he's so skeevy, in, like, the best worst way. I don't know. Like, you really want to punch him several times. At least I do. Every time I watch the movie, there are a few times I'd really like to punch him through the screen. But I think it's just, like, the believability that all of them have together that makes it so wonderful. And so much of like how they portray the dialogue, because there are so many quotes that I just love from this movie. Like there's a moment where Naomi Watts' character is like, why don't I have any self-respect? And the response is, you're an actress, honey. And you know, I think, you know, anyone who's done theater kind of is like, oh yeah, that's kind of accurate. But
yeah.
Just their very real visceral reactions to one another, I think, is what really makes this movie stand out to me. You know, I think we've all had moments where we'd love for a light to drop on somebody's head, but the fact that, you know, Regan is like, I did that. It was my fault.
Oh, he was terrible.
The blood coming out of his ear was the most honest thing he's done so far.
Oh, that's so good. So good. Such a good line. It's funny because, like, you know, you can kind of, like, from a theater person perspective, you know, you might be able to look at one of these characters and be like, oh yeah, I completely connect with that one character because I feel what they're going through. I feel like probably most theater people can connect with all of the actors in this movie in one way or another, because it's like, you know, with Michael Keaton, you know, if you've played a certain part over and over again, you want to be able to find that one that gives you respect, that gives you, you know, makes people see you for more than just that. For Edward Norton, there's this like pomposity and like just like better than everyone kind of feeling that he has, where it's like, no, this is all for my craft, man. You know, that kind of guy. And then Naomi Watts is like, you know, she just wants to be successful. She just wants something. Yeah. This is her first time on Broadway, so she wants this to go well and have somebody, you know, much like Michael Keaton's character, but to a different, for a different reason. She just wants to be able to finally earn that respect and recognition. And then I think Andrea Riseborough's character is kind of like, you know, she, of course, the character has its own, her own kind of like drama and stuff going on with the relationship that she has with Regan. But I think for her as an actor, she's just the kind of like, I'm going to put my head down. I'm going to keep going. I'm going to do this show. I might subtly be the glue that holds this whole like collapsing thing together. And I just, I love that they all are so, so different in their approach to those characters, but so real, like so painfully realistic,
so believable. Yeah
And it's fun too to kind of watch like the interaction with the you know, that Michael Keaton has with the Zach Galifianakis character. I can't remember this. He's not an agent, he's like kind of like producing partner, is that right?
I believe so. He also calls him like a million other things. At one point he says he's also his lawyer and I think he is helping produce.
I almost feel like we all have that guy too. Like the one who's just kind of wearing all the hats. Yeah, wears all the hats at the same time. And it's just like, you can count on them for everything, even if they wish you couldn't.
Yes. Yeah. I think one of my favorite moments with Zach Galifianakis' character is when he comes in, he's like, don't worry about it. I heard that Martin Scorsese's going to be in the audience. And then he leaves and they're like, is he really? He's like, yeah. And the new Pope.
And the new Pope. So good. So good. It's such a cleverly written movie too.
Yes.
Because I always feel like when you do a movie and you have a lot of like pop culture references, you run the risk of it feeling maybe too much of that time, where it's like, you know, years later you go back and you watch it and you're like, oh man, who are these people? Or you know, new audiences discover this movie and they're like, oh, who are these people that they're talking about? I feel like they handle it here in such a way where it's kind of like, oh, well, this has a certain, you know, certain timelessness to it, even though they're using these very specific people. I just think it. I just think it makes it really fun. It kind of makes it so it feels like it is a part of this world. And a lot of movies don't do that. They try and kind of separate themselves from the actual world that we live in. So yeah, I just really enjoy that. What are some other things about this movie that you really love and enjoy?
Well, I of course love the scene where Michael Keaton is running down Times Square in nothing but his tighty whities. I
Oh,
think you
man.
can't talk about this movie and not mention that scene,
Yeah.
right?
Yeah. Oh, how like I just, you think of it from the character standpoint of like, oh my God, this person has got to be like, it's terrifying. They didn't expect to be there. But then you also have to think of it from Michael Keaton's perspective at the time, because it's like he's still doing this, even though he's aware that he has to do this. I wouldn't do that. No way.
I think that takes a lot of gumption and a lot of courage. I'm not sure I would be able to do it either. But yeah, I love that scene. Just like the drums are playing and all this stuff's happening, and poor Riggin is running down the street in his underwear. He just
That's
wanted a
why. Yeah,
cigarette.
it's why you shouldn't smoke during a show. You shouldn't
Yes.
smoke.
And then I just really love the soundtrack. I love the use of drums at very, like it's primarily drums, but just at very specific important moments. I think just adds so many wonderful elements to what's happening in the movie. I think
It's such
soundtracks
a
are sometimes very underplayed, and I feel like this one is just so good.
Like it's just such a like it's very jazzy, but like not in an annoying kind of jazzy. I'm not a jazz fan, so but
Fair
it's
enough.
like it's just a kind of like it really it's like the tension is building, and the drums kind of like echo that tension in the scenes, and it just feels so cool. Like it's just kind of this free flowing like pulse of the movie, and I dig it. I dig it so much. It's such a good underrated soundtrack, because it's I don't know how you release the soundtrack as like something necessarily commercially viable. Like, oh yeah, I'm gonna go pick up the Birdman soundtrack. But I think in the
Some
context of the
drums.
movie, yeah, just some random drums. I'm gonna listen to that on my drive home. But I think in the context of the movie, it's like
It works so well.
it's yeah, perfect, perfect. There's one sequence in the movie that I wanted to make sure we talked about.
Yeah, of
And
course.
it's kind of like it's weird, because I want to call it like this fantasy sequence, but I feel like towards the end of the movie, like fantasy and reality bleed together
Blur.
in just this like really chaotic, really crazy way. And it's the scene where Michael Keaton or Riggin is walking down the street, and he is being harassed by Birdman about like, throughout the whole movie, like he hears Birdman's voice in his head of like, what are you trying to do? What are your expectations? Like, why would you do this? You're bigger than this. And then finally, like Birdman shows up and is basically stalking him and telling him, that we shouldn't be doing this. We should be doing another Birdman movie. And then like all hell breaks loose, like
There's
something
like a
explodes.
mechanical, huge evil thing.
And it is like, if you're not on board with the movie and what the movie is like doing and saying, and just don't really click with what's happening, I feel like that scene is really gonna be very confusing.
Agreed.
But man, it's like it really puts the idea of being a commercial actor against the, you know, being an artistic actor. It puts them like, you know, those worlds collide, and it is just this like really interesting sequence with, like, you know, I feel like the whole budget of the movie was probably used in creating the special effects for that probably. Scene. But I mean, then you get Michael Keaton like floating and flying around the city,
yes,
which is just beautiful. Like, the cinematography in this movie is so good.
Yes.
Just a wild movie. How did you, you know, I hate to ask how you interpreted that scene or how you took to that scene the first time you watched it, because I probably imagine the specifics of that might be a little blurry right now, but upon your like rewatch of it or watching it again, how does that scene stand out to you? Is that kind of like this, not necessarily like the part that breaks you or anything like that, but just is that a moment for you that stands out as something that kind of like turns this movie in a different direction?
Yes, I think so. And it kind of correlates with like the end, right? Of not having the answers of what actually happens. And so I think that moment is important to really set up for us these two worlds and how they're battling, you know, the artistic artistic actor versus the commercial actor. And can they ever merge, or do they have to be completely separate things? And it kind of, for me, goes back to that question then of like, what is real? And what isn't real, and how do we deal with those things? Mm-hmm. So I remember being like, what the world is this? Very first time I watched it, but like laughing a little bit because of the point that's obviously trying to be made. But I just rewatched it before we talked about it, so I could have it fresh in my mind. And I just, every time I'm still subtly caught off guard by like that huge, like, metal looking bird, and it like breathing fire, and like no one notices,
right?
You know, because obviously it's just Regan thinking about these things, but at the same time, like, is there commentary there too? Like, no one notices. So even if he goes back to do another Birdman movie, will anyone notice? And of course, you know, obviously there you can draw so many parallels because it happened to be Michael Keaton who was cast in this movie. In terms of, you know, I think back to the Flash movie, and I'll be truthful and say the only reason I wanted to see the Flash movie was because I knew Keaton was in it, you 100%. know, and seeing him in the costume again, it was a big deal. So I think, you know, people would care, people would notice for Regan if he did a Birdman movie again, but would it be the same? I don't know, you know, probably be different. Because it's been 20 years since he put it on. So you know, and like I said, I think that ties into the end then too. You know, we don't know what happened. We can make assumptions about what happens at the end. But we don't know, you know, his daughter looks up and that's when she smiles. So again, what's real, what isn't?
Yeah, I wanna talk about that ending for, I think, probably before we start to kind of wrap things up here. It's a moment that after what happened, that her looking up is just this moment that leaves me with a sense of hope in the movie and a sense of like, that everything's going to be okay for these characters. And I don't know if I'm right. I don't know if that's like, I don't know, because it is so ambiguous. And I'm a person who, you know, 50% of the time I'll love a good ambiguous ending, but 50% of the time I'll also be like, oh, just tell me what happened.
Yep.
Tell me why this happened. But with Birdman, I think it's handled really well.
Yes.
And I'm so happy with the rest of the movie that I can take an ending that doesn't say, okay, well, this is how things end. Because it's handled in such an artistic way. And I think you did a really good job of kind of like talking about it there. But Maybe I will push thee to you. So what do you think happened? What is your assumption of what happened there? Did he fly away? Did Birdman fly away?
I like to think he did, just
Yeah.
because I think it gives based on what happens, like I said prior in the movie, I feel like that's how I want to imagine it ended. And so, see, like I'm the type of person who's like maybe 60-40 on how, or 70-30 on ambiguous endings, just because I'm very much an analytical person who's like, I want the answers. I don't want to have to figure out the answers. But I would agree with you on this one because I just think there's a beauty in not actually knowing what happened. But because, again, because she looks up and has that smile, I just feel like we're left with this hope of, like you said, things are going to be okay for these people. Things are going to move forward in a good way. And so I like to imagine that Birdman flew away.
Or like if you have to put the like non-symbolic spin on it, like if it's not like the realistic version of it, of course a human being did not fly away, but I feel like there's something in that element that it's like there's some kind of peace there. Like if you have to be super realistic about what happened, some kind of peace was attained, but for Regan, for his daughter. Like I feel like throughout the movie, there's clearly a care that the two of them have for each other, but it's a contentious relationship because they're both dealing with their own stuff and don't have, they don't have that extra time to carve out for the other person because they're so concerned with their own things. And then at the end of the movie, there's this kind of peace and common thread where they're like, oh, I see you. I see you here in this moment. I think it's such a really great way of kind of conveying, like, we want you to wonder about what happened, but we're going to kind of lead you just a little bit to know that everything is okay. And I like that. It makes it for a really beautiful movie that, or beautiful ending to a movie that sometimes is, showcases like the worst qualities of people. It's good to kind of see like that it ends on something that emphasizes the best in them. I love this movie. I'm so glad that you picked this one. Are there any other parts of this movie that you want to make sure that we cover before we kind of dive into the last section of the podcast?
The other moment that really sticks out to me is what is between Reagan and his daughter Sam, and it's when she has the toilet roll paper. The toilet paper roll, sorry, words are hard sometimes. Do you know what I'm
I
talking about? And
get
she and she's got all the marks on it, and she says, "This is how long the Earth has existed." And then she tears off one square, and she's like, "And this is how long, humanity has been around." And I think it's so again, it just ties back so beautifully to like what's happening in the film of we're so absorbed in what we have going on. Each of those individuals is so absorbed in what they have going on in their own lives. And it's such a beautiful moment to be like, hey, like life can stink sometimes, but just remember that in the grand scheme of things, like this is all that you're I forget what her line is, but it's something about our hubris, basically, and how like that's all we amount to is this one square of toilet paper.
And it's kind of like this great great worldview, how it's like, we're focused on this one ply sheet of toilet paper, and the whole world is this sprawling, continuous like this thing that keeps going, and there's more and more happening, and it's such a good worldview. Talking about that did remind me of one question I wanted to ask that I don't know if there is an answer for it, but I would just be interested to maybe hear your thoughts on it. What is the virtue of ignorance? Like, What do you think the subtitle of this movie is referring to? Because I don't know that I ever put a lot of thought into that, but what
You know,
is
I was
that?
thinking about that earlier because I thought you might ask about it. And, you know,
Yeah.
like in the grand scheme of things, the only answer I have for you is that's, of course, what the critic titles her
Oh
review. But what does she mean by that? And I don't, and I was trying to break it down because, like I said, I was sure we were going to end up talking about it. Because why have, you know, the subtitle if there's not merit to it, right? Like, don't have it if it's not important. But I don't know, because like obviously there's so many words put together here that do not normally go together. Virtue and
Well,
ignorance are not typically words I feel like we usually use in the same sentence.
Exactly. Well, I think it's funny because it's like, yeah, that is the headline that she uses, and I wonder if it is this way of burning him without actually, without being too intense about it. It's like he is able to
Yeah.
deliver a great performance
Even though he is
somehow.
ignorant towards everything that has to do with the theater. Yeah. That was kind of what I had landed on,
And
was that she, the ignorant was him. And she found some virtue in his stuff, even though he was rather ignorant about how he went about all of it. So.
This is a great movie. It
Yes.
was a lot of fun to go back and watch this movie again, because I hadn't forgotten about the movie, but I had forgotten just how much I enjoyed it. And it
Yep.
was just great to see all of these actors like really giving like just awesome performances across the board. And I had forgotten how many Academy Award nominations that this
Oh
movie
yeah,
had, was
yep.
had the year that it came out. And rewatching it, I'm like, well, yeah, of course. Michael Keaton, Emma
Yeah,
Stone, Edward Norton, all three of them got nominated. Sadly, none of them won, but absolutely deserving of the nominations. And this ended up
yes,
winning Best Picture the year that it came out. Deservedly so. Just a lot of fun.
yes.
Sarah, this has been just a blast chatting with you. You're not out of the woods yet. You've got one last section of the show. I like to call this part the Fat Five. These are five rapid-fire-ish questions that kind of gauge your general thoughts on movies. So, Sarah,
Okay.
are you ready for the Fat Five?
I am.
Ooh, all right, here we go. Question number one. This is the one that people end up hating me for, but I ask it anyway. What is your favorite movie of all time?
I'd probably have to go with Batman, the first Michael Keaton Batman. Yep. Just so many good memories with that one, and I will always claim Michael Keaton as my Batman, so
It doesn't matter how much I enjoy like another performance from another Batman, like he is still my Batman.
yeah,
So I get it. Totally get it. Question two is a two-parter. The first part is, who is your favorite male performer, your favorite actor?
Paul Rudd. Oh, I love Paul Rudd.
Huge Paul Rudd fan over here. So good. And then the flip
Oh,
side to that, then, who is your favorite actress, your favorite female performer?
right now, probably Margot Robbie.
Oh, she's great.
Yeah.
She's great. And she always chooses interesting roles. And I think that's just
Yes.
a ton of fun. It's nice to see her kind of like from Tonya Harding to Barbie. Like
Yeah, a
what a
variety of
spectrum to
things
cover.
happening.
Question number three. I guess the way that people would probably phrase this question is, who is your favorite director? I like to ask it a little bit differently. Is there a director that, if they had a movie coming out tomorrow, you wouldn't have to know the plot, wouldn't have to know the cast, anything like that? You would just know that they're attached to it. And if so, who is that director?
I really like Julie Taymor
Yes.
quite a bit,
Yes.
so she'd probably be at the top of my list.
Titus is one of the most visually stunning movies
Yes, it
I have ever
is.
seen. I love that movie so much. That's one that, this is a big Blu-ray and 4K podcast at times, and that's one that I wish would get a really nice special edition, because
Oh,
I would
yeah,
buy
it
it
would look
the
beautiful, I'm sure.
the day it came out, I would be there for it. Question number four. Is there a movie scheduled to come out that you are really excited to see, or one that's already been released that you haven't had a chance to watch yet that you are super excited to see?
I really want to watch Oppenheimer. My husband
Yeah.
and I bought it, but we have not had,
Nice.
we like I told you, we've got two young children running around, and
Yep.
so trying to find 3 hours to sit down and watch a
Yeah.
movie is not always easy. So that one I'm
Right.
actually really intrigued to sit down and watch right
Yeah,
now.
good choice. Good choice. Yeah, it's very good. I mean, with all the Oscar nominations, of course, it's very good, but yeah, it's a very, very good movie. Last question. The name of the show is Let's Talk About It, or Let's Talk About. I use my rating scale is with tacos. And so I want to ask you to craft for me your perfect taco. What kind of protein are we using? What kind of shell are we going with? Make me your favorite taco.
Love it. Okay, so I'm probably gonna go with a corn tortilla, but like one of the
Yeah.
big ones.
Yeah.
And then I'm a chicken kind of person, so I'm gonna go with the
Yep.
chicken and a mild salsa because my tongue is like the wimpiest tongue that has ever existed.
Yeah.
And then I'd probably throw some guac, and of course you gotta have cheese, all the cheese. My mother-in-law likes to say there's no such thing as too much cheese, and I tend to
Yeah.
agree with her. Sour cream, black olives. Yeah, I think that's
Yeah.
probably it.
That sounds great. That sounds great. I'm a big chicken taco guy too. So this sounds delicious. And once again, I made the mistake of not eating before I recorded the podcast. So
Oh
it's
no. Now
time to
you're
go get some
hungry.
food. Sarah, this has just been a ton of fun for me. Thank you so much for doing this episode. Is there a place online where people can follow you if they want to, or follow your school's theater program?
Yeah, for sure. So if you want to follow me personally on Instagram, my handle is Sarah Belfridge Honorman. It's all mashed together. And if you're interested in following along our journey at the theater, our Instagram is MISU Performing Arts on Instagram.
Awesome. Again, Sarah, thank you so much. It was great to
Thanks.
chat with
Thanks for
you and
having
great to chat
me.
about this movie. Yeah. And we'll have to talk again sometime.
I would love that.
Once again, a huge thank you to Sarah Honorman for that. That was a great conversation. I really enjoy just doing the show in general, and most guests all seem to be like it's just this easy conversation to have. So when I say, I pointed out that one guest was like, "Oh, this was just such an easy conversation to have," it's never like because any of the other conversations aren't. It's just because in that moment, man, it just felt like a good conversation. It was cool getting to know her. She's got a fun story, and this is a really great movie to talk about. So, again, a huge thank you to Sarah for doing the show. That's gonna do it for this week's episode. You can follow all things Fat Dude Digs Flicks on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Letterboxd, TikTok, any social media. Just do a search for Fat Dude Digs Flicks and you will find me there. Subscribe to this podcast, like this podcast, rate and review this podcast. Share this podcast with your friends. Like I say, I'm going to keep doing this thing until I don't want to anymore. And I'm going to do that regardless of how many listeners I have. But man, it would sure be cool to have more listeners. The best way to do that is with your help. So please, if you know somebody who would like conversations about movies or just conversations about people, share this podcast with them. If you're using Apple Podcasts or Spotify, please leave a rating and a review because that also helps get us out there to new people. If you do subscribe to this podcast, not only do you get Let's Talk About, but you also get the Criterion Break, where I am joined by Blake Ginnethan and Derek Vierink, and we talk about our love for the Criterion Collection proper and the Criterion Channel. And you also get The Balcony, and that is a Blake and Derek kind of like lead-fronted podcast, and I kind of take the back seat on it, still in part of the conversation, but this is a podcast where Blake and Derek kind of catch all the other movie stuff that they want to talk about, that they want to, you know, have conversations about that maybe we miss in this podcast, miss in the Criterion Break. And we had our first episode last week, and it was a ton of fun, and I can't wait to get more episodes of The Balcony out there. So definitely subscribe to this feed because you're going to get some really good stuff. And that's not just ego talking. Like that's a fan of movies talking about, you know, good conversations with good people about movies. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, suggestions, recommendations, want to be a guest on the show, want to leave a donation to help offset the cost of the show, please send an email to fatdudediggsflicks@gmail.com. Alright, I'm going to try and get through this list. Please, 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 if you like our show, listen to Screams from the Basement, hosted by Casey Kelderman and Sam Lenz. It is a couple of horror fans talking about horror. They do great stuff on their show, and they do great interviews as well. Listen to the Local Lou podcast. Local Lou talks about Sioux Falls and South Dakota history. A ton of fun. Like, it's just really interesting to hear things about South Dakota history. Listen to Reliving the Lights. Again, sorry, Anthony, I don't know that your OC podcast has started yet. I will find that out, and as soon as it does, I'll start plugging that. But yeah, it's hosted by Anthony Hookman and one of his friends, where they go through the entire filmography, or not filmography, but entire episode run of Friday Night Lights. That show has, that the podcast has wrapped up, but it is still fun to go back and listen to them go through the show. And Talking with Tasha, from former local radio personality Tasha, where she just it's a cornucopia of content on her show. And I was actually recently a guest, and I don't know when that drops, but soon. So if you listen and subscribe to Talking with Tasha, you get to hear that. But even outside of my episode, if you like pop culture as a whole, she's a great person to listen to. If you have a local podcast and you wanted to make sure that I plug it in this round robin, let me know. That's gonna do it for this week's episode of the show. Thank you so much for listening. Please be safe out there. Please enjoy yourself. And with that, we'll see you in here next week. Same fat time, same fat channel, and let's talk about movies. A good day.
Thank you for listening to Fat Dude Digs Flicks.